This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support comes from Brian Lowe Financial. We start with Michael Medved, the author of 13 previous books, starting with the bestseller, What Really Happened in the Class of 65. And he is, of course, a ubiquitous presence in national media, heard coast to coast on the Michael Medved Show, a three-hour daily radio program, member of USA Today's Board of Contributors, former chief film critic of the New York Post, and was the longtime co-host of Sneak Previews on PBS. He was a Yale Law School classmate of one Bill and Hillary Clinton, and his latest work is God's Hand on America, Divine Providence in the Modern Era. And good morning to you, Michael Medved.
Hey, good morning, Jim, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. And you are a believer. We've talked about your state in life. You are an Orthodox Jew, and you live in the great city of Seattle. So you are a minority in this country, but you, like many others, believe that our country has been blessed by a higher power. And the book goes into detail about some of the cases in which God may have intervened to help America from itself. But do you believe that we still have the divine providence, as you say, in the modern era?
Yes, I do, and I'll tell you why. Because I think what the evidence suggests, and this is really the theme of my book, is the providential protection is really instrumental. It's utilitarian. In other words, it is to save a broader purpose than simply as a reward for Americans for being better than other people. I actually think that America's special blessing, which all of our founders believed in, including those who were religiously skeptical, that special blessing is not to reward America. It's to advance the general proposition that Dr. King spoke about when he said the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. In other words, if you were to use any collection of people, any nation state, as an instrument of advancing humanity, advancing the cause of civilization, you wouldn't pick Belgium. I mean, you wouldn't pick Guatemala. You would pick the United States of America, whose entire emergence as the dominant power in the world is one of those things that is so illogical and so much goes against what people would have expected 400 years ago, that I think one can say that all those past Americans, including, by the way, people like Franklin Roosevelt and John Kennedy and Barack Obama, saw something that wasn't quite rational, wasn't quite explicable in purely human terms.
We're going to go to some of the accounts you have of previous presidents, going back to the days of the 16th, Abraham Lincoln, but let's start with number 45. And one of the most telling graphs in your book is, you write, the most dispiriting aspect of the current polarization is the unlimited godlike power that both sides impute to a single flawed and fascinating human being. And we're talking about Donald John Trump. Could you expand on that?
Sure. It's one of those things. I actually have a fairly hostile reaction whenever people say that Trump has been selected by a higher power to save America, and without Trump, America would have gone down. And I also get very annoyed when I hear people saying that, oh, if Trump is reelected, America is doomed, we have no future. The point is, he is president of the United States. You can either revere him or you can abominate him. But the point is, America has survived, and America has survived for a higher purpose. And I don't think that it's likely that President Trump will either succeed in, quote, making America great again, because I don't think America ever ceased being great. Nor do I believe that Trump is the end of civilization as we know it. And it's a very annoying aspect of our current debates that people have this totally Manichaean notion about Trump. He's either pure evil or he's pure goodness. And I think the evidence is pretty overwhelming that he's neither one exactly.
You're a devout man, and I'm getting the impression, Michael, correct me if I'm wrong, that you believe that God would not allow our country to select somebody who would be a total disaster, who would destroy the country and perhaps by extension the world.
It would not allow him a total disaster. Now, obviously, we've had some disastrous selections in the past. I think, for instance, the selection of Franklin Pierce in the election of 1852 helped to bring on the war between the states and to lead to every kind of slaughter and to preserve the evil institution of slavery, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Sure, American voters, because I believe in free will, I think most religious believers do, American voters can make mistakes. What I'm saying is that one or two or five or ten mistakes are not terminal for a project of the scope of American civilization. In other words, here we are, we're now 3 years almost into the Trump presidency, which is kind of amazing when you think it seems like longer than that. But 3 years into the Trump presidency, America, certainly there are certain aspects of the country that have changed. I don't think our political culture is doing wonderfully. But the truth is the nation isn't unrecognizable. It isn't utterly transformed for better or worse. And I think that it's very important that we begin looking at the presidential choice as basically following Bismarck's example when it comes to divine providence. Bismarck, the Iron Chancellor of Germany, said any great statesman listens for God's footsteps in history, and then grabs his coattails and tries to hang on.
Now, your book mentions Franklin Roosevelt many times. It mentions Adolf Hitler a few times, and they were on the world stage at the same time, died 18 days apart. How did the United States get FDR and Germany get Hitler when we're talking at the time the two most sophisticated countries in the world? How did something like this happen?
Well, first of all, I think our allies, the Brits, who got Winston Churchill a little bit later than America got, actually 8 years later, 7 years later than America got Roosevelt or that Germany got Hitler. But I think that the Brits would count as one of the most civilized nations in the world at the time, too. The one thing that I am fascinated about, which is something that very few Americans recognize, is that the two most vital people in actually winning World War II, the most decisive battle, conflict in all of human history, Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt, both came extraordinarily close to death within 14 months of each other before either man had come to power. And Roosevelt was president-elect. He was about to be inaugurated for his first term 2 weeks later. And he was in Miami, and a crazed anarchist bricklayer named Giuseppe Zangara took 5 shots at him from 10 feet away. And remarkably, though he killed another bystander, the mayor of Chicago, Tony Chermack, and though there were 4 other people who were injured, Roosevelt, who was a sitting duck because he was paralyzed, of course, because of his polio, he emerged unscathed. And this actually had a profound impact on the American public because a lot of people, including people who had been skeptical about the governor of New York, who was often written off as a lightweight who wasn't up to his cousin Theodore, a lot of people all of a sudden saw his selection as president as providential. And given the fact that the vice president who had been elected with Roosevelt, John Nance Garner, was an isolationist, and is the kind of man who would not have rearmed America, would not have helped Britain in its hour of need during the Battle of Britain the way Roosevelt did. This is the most, one could say, consequential missed assassination in all of human history. And then what's fascinating is 14 months before, Churchill had been in New York City. He was on a speaking tour. And Churchill like to imbibe. I think that's not a secret to people. Yeah. And he was going over to Bernard Baruch's house to get some prohibition booze. And as he was crossing Fifth Avenue in New York City, He was struck by a car going 35 miles an hour. And the wheels of the car came very close to crushing his skull. He was in the hospital for 10 days after the accident. And Churchill wrote about it and said, I don't know why I was spared from death. And, of course, this is at a time when he had virtually retired from politics during his wilderness years. And just a few months later, or actually a few years later, Churchill returned to politics and saved the world.
The book from Michael Medved, who will be with us for another segment, is God's Hand on America, Divine Providence in the Modern Era. Michael's written 13 best-selling books, graduate of Yale University, law school classmate of the Clintons, and he's been a frequent guest with us through the years. And more than 5 million people each week listen to his nationwide radio show. And we will return, if you'd like to join the conversation, 877-217-5757. Talk at talklouisiana.org is our email address, and we are back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana. Matt Doyle is producing, and our guest for a bit longer is Michael Medved, the well-known commentator, columnist, conservative, and, of course, he's expressed his reservation about the President of the United States. His latest work is God's Hand on America, believing that God has touched our country and saved us from disaster in the past with some divine intervention. 877-217-5757. We'll take a call or two before we part company with Michael Medved. But a listener asks at talklouisiana.org, why would God intervene and save Roosevelt and allow John Fitzgerald Kennedy to be blown away in 1963 in Dealey Plaza? What's your take on that?
Well, my take is to believe that God intervenes at crucial moments for the sake of the United States doesn't mean that terrible things don't happen here. I address in my immediate previous book is called The American Miracle, and it ends with the Lincoln assassination. And that assassination was devastating to the country. I mean, if you look at President Andrew Johnson. In other words, to say that God has a plan for the country doesn't mean that that plan means that America never loses, never suffers. Obviously, we do. And the one thing that one can say about John Kennedy is the Civil Rights Bill, which was enormously important for the country at the time, probably would not have been passed. Medicare would not have been passed if Kennedy hadn't perished the way he did and Johnson taken over and immediately rushed through to get those pieces of legislation that were fairly important for the country to go through. Now, that's a weak kind of explanation. I don't think that's dispositive. But the truth of the matter is that after all of the turmoil and horror of the 60s, and I have a chapter about that. I have a chapter about Dr. King's death. And I was present for Robert Kennedy's assassination, because I had been working in Robert Kennedy's presidential campaign. And the idea of the 60s, this is really the quote that comes to the book, is that leads to the book, is the great novelist John Updike said right after Robert Kennedy's assassination, I now believe that God has withdrawn his special blessing for America. And if you look at what's happened with this country since 1968, when that statement was made, since 1968, we've won the Cold War. We have greatly influenced the rest of the world in terms of eradicating poverty, eradicating or greatly reducing the impact of AIDS in Africa, basically raising, making tremendous progress in this country on race, on poverty, on a whole range of issues. And this is bipartisan. I'm one of those people, Jim, who believes that as we look back on the decade that began with the recession, say, in 2010, America's done remarkably well. I had on my show yesterday Matt Ridley, who's a member of the House of Lords, who wrote a book called Rational Optimism. And he argues, and I think he's right, that this decade of 2010 to 2020, in terms of improved standards of living, health, opportunities, creative expression, everything, is the greatest single decade in all of human history when it comes to the scope and range of the progress.
Sabash at the Country Club of Louisiana. Good morning, Sabash. You're on Talk Louisiana with Michael Medved.
Good morning, Mr. Engster, and good morning to you, Mr. Medved. I am familiar with Mr. Medved's philosophies. It's interesting that he wants us to wait until the total disaster happens before you would try to unseat the president, current president, or he does not remember that we took 200 years to abolish slavery and God did not interfere.
All right. Would you respond, Michael? I think he mischaracterized your stance on President Trump, but how did slavery last for so long with a divine presence in our country?
Sure. The United States was hardly unique with the institution of slavery. In fact, we were basically a footnote. Slavery was terrible, but it was absolutely universal. The United States played, along with Great Britain, a more prominent role by far in the abolition of slavery than in the institution of slavery. This is one of those things that I think people really, really do need to take to heart, is that according to all historians, of the 11 million human beings who were kidnapped in Africa and taken across the ocean in slavery to various destinations, fewer than 4% of them ever came to North America. They came to places like the West Indies, the Caribbean, to Brazil, where a third of the population is descended from slaves. And slavery was evil. It was completely antithetical to American ideals. And the fact is that at a time when in human history there seemed to be a profound change, beginning with the British abolition of the slave trade, 40 years before it happened in America, that America was a big part of that.
Mike in Villa Del Rey. Mike, you're on Talk Louisiana with Michael Medved, author of God's Hand on America. Mike, you have the floor.
So a guy lived through the Holocaust, and he died. He went to heaven, and he met God at the pearly gates and told him a joke about Auschwitz. And God said, "I don't get it." God says, "I guess you had to be there. Have a good holiday."
All right, I don't know what your point is, but that's a bit unusual. Dan, downtown Baton Rouge. Dan, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Mr. Medved, is it just as likely that there is no God and everything just occurs by happenstance?
There are a series of incidents going back to very early in American history, and my book treats incidents between 1865 and the current day. For instance, it is utterly remarkable and illogical that William Henry Seward, the Secretary of State, who was supposed to be assassinated the same night that Lincoln was spared. And it is because he was spared, because of a carriage accident that had occurred 9 days before and a brace that he was wearing on his neck, that he wasn't killed. And the fact that he wasn't killed made it possible for the United States to acquire Alaska. And according to President Putin himself, the sale of Alaska to the United States, which Seward was entirely responsible for after the assassination attempt, won the Cold War. Putin believes, and many historians believe, that if Russia had maintained this huge chunk of real estate in North America, that the outcome of the titanic struggle against the evil empire of the Soviet Union might have been very different.
75 years ago, as we speak, we were in the midst of the Battle of the Bulge. The world was about to change dramatically. The deaths of Franklin Roosevelt and Adolf Hitler would occur in April of 1945. And you note that if Roosevelt had not switched to Harry Truman as his vice president, that Henry Wallace would have been the vice president and the world might have been completely different.
Well, and Henry Wallace came to believe that. This was the amazing thing that I found in doing my book. Henry Wallace, I think people know, it's been exposed, had a great deal of contact with the American Communist Party and with Joseph Stalin. He was an apologist for Stalin. Later in life, he acknowledged that it was a good thing that there was a switch to Truman. Truman was the right man, and the story of his replacement of Wallace on the ticket, 82, and in his fourth term that Roosevelt was elected to, he only lasted 82 days. And that's one of the most fateful presidencies ever, because Truman, of course, authorized the attack on Hiroshima. He presided over all the architecture that won the Cold War. I also feature in the book a paper by George Kennan, which talks about the role of Providence, and which outlines in his famous Long Telegram the whole basis for winning the Cold War. And I think that's important reading.
The book from Michael Medved is God's Hand on America, Divine Providence in the Modern Era. And we're glad you're still in the game, Michael, and I'm sure you will be for many more years, and we look forward to visiting with you in 2020. Happy New Year to you.
Well, thank you, and thank you for all the good wishes and for your great work, Jim, and may this be the best New Year ever for you and everybody in Louisiana.
Thank you so much, and best to you and Seattle, one of the beautiful places on the planet. Michael Medved, always a pleasure. We'll talk soon.
Look forward. Thank you.
And we'll be back after this pause for the news. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support from Brian Lowe Financial. And in-house is George Morris, who has been in Baton Rouge since 1982. He came here with the old State Times and was covering sports, the LSU beat writer for many years until that newspaper folded. He worked in sports for The Advocate for a while, and for the last many years, he's been a feature writer and writes prolifically about war veterans, particularly the Second World War, and even has a website. And again, George Morris, that website is?
www.the big one, O-N-E.com. www.the big one.
And George has a storehouse of information about people who were present in World War II, both as warriors and as citizens. And most recently, before we get to the 75th anniversary of the Battle of the Bulge, you found a lady here in Baton Rouge who was present at Pearl Harbor on 7th December 1941.
Yes, Diane Grant, her stepfather was a Navy captain at the time. He later became a Rear Admiral. And she was awakened by a machine gun bullet going into her room and hitting the wall over her head. And she actually went out onto the sort of to the roof of her house, a little split level, and saw these planes attacking and first thought it was a drill until her mother screamed at her to get off there that it was the Japanese.
Was it inevitable that the United States would be involved in the Second World War, or would it not have happened if for Pearl Harbor?
Well, that's a big question. I think that certainly our support of what was going on in Europe, support of England, was was growing deeper, and but there was a significant number of percentage of people who just did not want to get into another European conflict. So it's, you need to ask a better historian than I am.
You're pretty good, George, and of course Hitler was a threat to the world, and if he had not been stopped when he was stopped, we just heard from Michael Medved about Divine Providence. He might have ruled the world.
Well, I mean, certainly he would have certainly ruled a big hunk of it. I don't know that ultimately that the Japanese would have ceded their part of the world that they were conquering at a pretty good clip at the time and had been conquering 6 years before Hitler invaded Poland.
Well, he was a terror to the world and, as we know, has left an indelible mark. And at this time in 1944, in the bitter cold of Belgium primarily, the U.S. was in perhaps the most distinct and certainly the most vivid battle of the war, the Battle of the Bulge, which lasted from 16 December 1944 to 25 January 1945, 1 month, 1 week, 2 days. How significant was that battle, George?
Well, it was enormously significant in a variety of ways. It's the costliest battle that the U.S. ever fought, and it was Hitler's last gamble to try to split the West, try to get a separate peace, get America and Great Britain to essentially come to terms because he was worried about the Soviet Union, which was advancing strongly, and was, you know, he could no longer fight a two-front war.
Well, the Germans achieved a surprise attack the morning of 16 December 1944, not unlike June 6th of 1944, which was, of course, the other way around.
Right.
A combination of Allied overconfidence, preoccupation with Allied offensive plans, and poor aerial reconnaissance due to horrible weather, and American forces in the early going bore the brunt of the attack and incurred their highest casualties of any operation during the war. And when we say high casualties, we're talking about thousands of people dying on both sides in this war.
Right.
Dying in this battle.
And dying not only from bullets, but from the bitter cold that you referenced. There were a lot of casualties, well, deaths and injuries of people from frostbite and freezing and things like this. It was perhaps as bad a weather situation as one could ever fight a major battle.
The American casualties, 89,500. Includes killed, wounded, missing, recaptured, and captured 733 tanks. In Germany, 63,000 casualties at a minimum. Killed, wounded, missing, captured 554 tanks lost. And the Americans lost 1,000 aircraft as well. The 733 were the tanks lost by the U.S. So at one point, and it was significant, the U.S. had superior power. How did that happen?
Okay, what's the...
Well, it started out as a surprise attack, but obviously the Americans got moving, and with its allies, the United States had more men on the ground than the Germans. How did that happen? Who was the strategist who made it occur?
Well, one of the significant people, one of the significant decisions was made by none other than the former LSU Corps of Cadets commander and dean of administration, and later president, Troy Middleton.
Right.
He was the commanding general of 8th Corps, and ultimately, you know, on the 16th, he awoke to the sound of artillery before it was yet light, and when he began to realize what was going on, he authorized the 101st Airborne to deploy to the Belgian town of Bastogne and to hold it, because he could read a map and he saw that this was where the critical highways all came there, and that if the Germans were to achieve their ultimate desire, which was to split the two forces and take all the way to the coast in Antwerp, Belgium, they would need Bastogne. And it was his decision that, you know, that sent the 101st there and then created that very dramatic siege in which the forces held until they were relieved. I think it was on Christmas Day or Christmas Eve by Patton's horses.
General Patton was less than a year from death. At 59 years old, he was in the Battle of the Bulge, and that was more than a last hurrah. He was certainly active. How important was he to the success of the Allies?
Oh, I think he was enormously important. I mean, he had sort of understood the role of tanks in battle, and as the Allies post D-Day swept through France, it was his 7th Army that did just I believe he was 7th or 3rd. I forget. I think he was 3rd Army at this
George
point.
Patton was the
3rd Army.
Third Army.
He was 7th Army when he was in Africa in Sicily. But anyway, it was tremendously important, and all the way into Germany, and ultimately I think he finished the war in Czechoslovakia. But
well, when you look at the major players, it's a who's who of the world at that time, and this isn't Coach O against Lincoln Riley. The supreme Allied commanders were Dwight David Eisenhower and Adolf Hitler. So it was the war that perhaps was the catalyst for what happened in April of 1945. Certainly, the end of the Third Reich would not have happened as soon without the success of the Battle of the Bulge. Could Hitler see the writing on the wall when his troops lost?
Well, he certainly had to. I mean, again, the Battle of the Bulge from the German perspective was a Hail Mary. I mean, if you want to analogize this to football, they were down by 17 points with 4 minutes left in the game, and so it was a three score game. So the first thing he had to do is was again to split the U.S. and the British, try to get a peace, and then take all those troops and put them to the Eastern Front because, to use another football coach's epic phrase, from the Soviet Union's perspective, we coming. They were coming. And so Hitler could not fight a two-front war. And once the Battle of the Bulge failed, he was doomed.
Well, it was his choice to fight a two-front war, wasn't it?
It was initially his choice to fight a two-front war, but then after the fall of France, it was essentially a one-front war because there was no land operation. Now, there was North Africa, but at this point, I guess to correct what I said, he could no longer fight a two-front war, would be more accurate.
Now, the world has not revered the Battle of the Bulge in the same way as D-Day. Is there a Battle of the Bulge museum? You would know, George. I'm unaware of one, if there is one. But
well, I'm not aware of one.
Perhaps there should be.
And perhaps there is in Belgium. I really don't know.
But as far as significance, and of course the carnage, too, and the people, it was a war or a battle like few, if any, others at that time or any time. And there was a movie made, 1965, that was not... It's not the Ten Commandments. Most people don't say, did you ever see the Battle of the Bulge? But why have we not held this in the same reverence as we do other points in history?
Well, it's a good question to which I'm not sure I really have a good answer. I mean, it was sort of a step along the way. I mean, at the beginning, the Battle of the Bulge was a mistake. It was a lack of planning. It was a lack of foresight on our part, the idea that, I mean, Germany could even amass such a large force relatively undetected. It's kind of interesting that there were a number of frontline troops, and this was a lightly held section. It was thought to be so hilly and so wooded and so difficult that the Germans would not try to put a major offensive there, so we did not have a lot of troops there. And a lot of the frontline troops actually reported hearing all these what they assumed to be tanks and mechanized vehicles, you know, moving during the night, but they were just assumed to be panicking because they were green soldiers and inexperienced.
We'll spend more time with George Morris. We'll also talk about a battle in Atlanta tomorrow, LSU in Oklahoma. The Peach Bowl that will determine one of them going to the national championship game. We're back after this brief pause. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana, and hope you had a great holiday, and it continues, and the 2020 will be happy and prosperous for all of our listeners. 75 years ago in Germany and Belgium and surrounding area, the U.S. was at war with the Third Reich, and the Battle of the Bulge was the deadliest campaign in World War II, and we noted the almost 90,000 casualties the U.S. had during the Battle of the Bulge. And I noted that there was a movie made about it, and a listener, Tom on Bluebonnet, noted that in 1970, 5 years later, a movie called Patton did much better.
Quite a bit. It was an extraordinary piece of filmmaking.
And George, being the World War II, we're visiting with George Morris, who is a guy who knows more about World War II than anyone locally that I know of. You probably were touched by the Battle of the Bulge. You would have been about 14 when that movie came out in February of 1970. I suspect it had a huge impact on you.
Well, I didn't see it at the time, but I did see it later, and I still have the VCR tapes it was quite a movie. It's a lot of it was Hollywood. I mean, it was not a documentary, but it was quite well done. And of course, the Bulge played a key part of that as Patton's forces very quickly moved up from where they were to the south of the battle and were able to relieve Bastogne, which sort of broke the back of the German offensive. Now, that was, again, I think, on Christmas Day, and there was an entire month left of driving the Germans back and reclaiming the real estate that had been lost. And a lot of people think that the Battle of the Bulge ended when Bastogne was relieved, but that was the beginning of the end, or the end of the beginning, but it was certainly not not the end of the battle.
I bet the first time you saw Patton, you cried.
I don't know if I cried, but I was just, I thought it was it was very well done, and certainly the incredible ending where, of course, Patton has been relieved of command, and he's out there, you know, walking his dog, and in his mind he's thinking about the how Roman generals returning from victory would be given a parade and all these sorts of things, but there would be a slave holding a crown above his head and whispering in his ear that all glory is fleeting. And of course, it was in his case, it was shortly after that that he got into the traffic accident that paralyzed and ultimately took his life.
Well, Hitler's plan called for a blitzkrieg attack through the weakly defended Ardennes, mirroring a German offensive in the Battle of France in 1940. And there are reports that have been recalled regarding the friction that was going on between the commanders of the 1st and 2nd Armies, Montgomery and Bradley, that Hitler was aware of, and he hoped to exploit the disunity in the U.S. troops. And he thought that four armies would be trapped without supplies behind German lines. Well, it did not work the way the Fuhrer wanted it to. Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, you're on Talk Louisiana. Good morning, Phil. You're on with George Morris.
Good morning, gentlemen. Did Hitler know that Japan was going to attack the United States? I mean, I understand that they had a treaty to go to war with countries that attacked them. I mean, the Italians and the Japanese, the Axis. But since Japan attacked a surprise attack on the U.S., that Hitler was not really required to go to war with us, but did decide to declare war on us.
It's a great question to which I do not have an answer.
Well, Hitler, in 1941, was profiled in Current Biography, a publication that continues, and this is before the U.S. is involved in World War II. And this was the lead graph in the profile of Adolf Hitler, which gives his date of birth, place of birth, and even his current address at the time. It says, even if enough civilization is left for the next century to regard the 20th with a calm historic eye, there will probably be at least one romanticist among that generation's writers who will find in the story of the Austrian house painter who came to rule Europe Europe enough fact and legend to awe the young and fire their imaginations with the glory of ruthlessness and the fascination of personal power. He was a guy who was well known to be a force to be reckoned with, and the United States ultimately took him out. And George, when he took his life on April 30th, 1945, I'm sure the world had a collective sigh of relief.
Well, I would suspect so.
Yeah, and those who lived through that time, you have captured many of them while they were still lucid, and unfortunately, many of them are no longer with us. There are very few still alive, because if you were 20 years old in 1944, you'd be 75 or 95 today. So they're few and far between now.
Well, I consider myself very fortunate to have actually, as you mentioned, I came here as a sports writer. I made the move to features in spring of 42. I'm sorry, spring of 92. And I knew that there must be a lot of stories out there, and everything was becoming a 50th anniversary of the war. And so I got the almost carte blanche from our editors to go find these people and find these stories, and really have been some incredible ones.
And they were still around in
absolutely. Absolutely.
94 and 95 in the 50th anniversary, but 25 years as a generation, and that generation, the greatest one, is all but gone. But I would concur with Tom Brokaw that it was the greatest generation.
Well, I certainly am not going to argue it. It was part of my father's generation, part of your father's generation. They confronted really just a tremendous evil that was set loose in the world. And we're not perfect, but they I think they did right.
Tomorrow in Atlanta, George, if you were still covering the Tigers, you would be at Mercedes-Benz Stadium for LSU versus Oklahoma. And I can almost hear Keith Jackson's voice.
Oh, Nelly. Yes.
Barn burner, right? But it should be quite a game. LSU's a two-touchdown favorite, but you've got two iconic programs in the history of college football, and they converge in Atlanta.
Well, you've got two great programs. You've got some great quarterbacks. You have two great offenses. You know, it's remarkable how in a short period of time. I mean, the last time LSU played Oklahoma on a stage, well, actually a bigger stage, was the national championship game, the BCS championship game, at the end of the 2003 season.
Mm-hmm.
It was the number one rated total defense against the number one rated scoring defense. And now the game has so radically changed, mm-hmm, that they're scoring at records that would just have been unbelievable at the time.
Well, the New York Times today breaks down the comparison of Joe Burrow and Jalen Hurts, the two quarterbacks. And Burrow had a great season, but so did Hurts, who, of course, transferred from Alabama. Total offense, Burrow 5,004 yards, Hurts 4,889 yards. Points responsible for, Burrow 308, Hurts 308. So there's not a lot to choose from between the two quarterbacks of different styles. Hurts ran for almost 1,300 yards.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, that's and that's certainly something that that every team has to deal with. And there have been some times this season in which a running quarterback has really gashed LSU.
Ole Miss, in
the Ole Miss game is in particular. And so, yeah, it's something that they have to concern themselves with. By the same token, they're going into this game with plenty of time to prepare. It's not a one-week turnaround, mm-hmm, such as it was after, I think Ole Miss Ole Miss game was immediately after Alabama. Correct?
Yes.
And so, you don't have that same.
But Oklahoma's a little bit better than Ole Miss.
No question about that.
No question about it. And we're talking about one of the top four teams in the country, and LSU has had three close games this year, so it could be close, and heaven forbid, it could be a defeat. But can you imagine, George? I've never seen the town this geared up. It's almost a fait accompli that LSU's going to win the national title. Imagine if they lost to Oklahoma. As Jim Wharton, the former chancellor, said, the whole state would have the mullygullies.
Well, it would be a buzzkill. There's no question about it. By the same token, I have not found anyone that I believe who has told me that they knew that that this season was going to transpire this way back in August and September. I think that should the worst happen, I think that certainly this remains a season to celebrate. But certainly everyone's hoping that it doesn't end here.
All right. I've got a text message here as we part company saying there are several museums which, of course, do showcase the Battle of the Bulge. And one that does, not as significantly as D-Day, is the World War II Museum in New Orleans. And, George, you've been a frequent customer there, I'm sure.
Yes, I have.
That's quite a place.
It's a remarkable place. And just recently they opened their own hotel because they've become such a destination point. That whereas it used to be people came to New Orleans and let's do the D-Day Museum. Now people come to the D-Day Museum and, oh, let's also do some New Orleans.
Thanks to Stephen Ambrose and to Tom Hanks and others. Signature support for Talk Louisiana comes from Brian Lowe Financial. We'll be back Monday, same time, same place. Until then, have a great weekend and stay tuned.